United Nations Radio presents Gary Cooper with the third in a special series of dramatic case histories, Shooting Gallery. Shooting Gallery. And to tell you this unusual true story, here is Gary Cooper.
Did you ever meet a dope addict? Did you ever speak to one? Did you ever wonder how an addict feels? What he thinks? How he got that way? Well, today you're going to meet some addicts face to face. These people could have been your neighbors, an engineer, a doctor, a judge, a 59-year-old lady, a high school kid. All dope addicts. What follows isn't play acting. The people we talk about are the people you'll hear. It's the real McCoy. Shooting Gallery, according to the jargon of the underworld, is where men and women who have been hooked can get a shot of dope. But what about those desperate people who can't get the stuff?
I've seen big, strong men sit up and cry all night. I've seen them tear their hair. I've seen them try to cut their wrists. I've seen them take the bulb out of the light and try to kill himself with it. Yes. Ready to get the glass.
That man ought to know how it feels, for he's a drug addict himself. His story is hard to believe. You'll hear the rest of it in a moment. Narcotics in the hands of your doctor can be a blessing, but in unlicensed hands, hell on earth. The United Nations knows that in the past, trying to stop illegal drugs from getting into a country was like grabbing at a balloon. Squeeze it in one place and it pops out in another. Experience has taught us that the only way to tackle the dope racket is on a worldwide scale. And to get a complete story on narcotics today, United Nations Radio assigned Jeff Spark to talk to everyone from government agents to UN scientists, from dope peddlers to their victims, and to record exactly what they said in their own words. UN reporter Sparks began at the end of the line. He flew down to Lexington, Kentucky, to the U.S. Public Health Service Narcotics Hospital. Down around Lexington, they call it Narco. That's where an addict finally winds up, if he's lucky enough. Half of Narco are federal prisoners, the other half have gone there voluntarily, but they all have one thing in common. They're trying to get off drugs and keep off. That's not as easy as it sounds. We told you, this story is hard to believe. Listen for yourself. This narcotics addict is a former criminal lawyer, a judge.
I have experienced what it can do to a man. At one time, I had a nice office, a nice practice. I had a happy family. I was making from $12,000 to $15,000 a year.
Yeah.
And I began to take a few drugs after drinking. First thing I knew, I was addicted.
Did you feel the need of those drugs?
Well, drugs get a hold on you, a hold on you. And it gets worse all the time.
I mean, what first gave you the idea?
Doctor gave them to me to get over being drunk.
Oh.
Now, I was a judge, and I was a successful criminal lawyer.
Yeah.
And I'd have a case, or I'd want to sit on the bench.
Yeah.
And the doctor would come and give me a dose of morphine.
Uh-huh.
And gradually it got so that I had to have it before I could attend to my practice. I spent a world of money. I expect I spent $40,000 to $50,000 on morphine.
Is that a fact?
Yes.
You're married?
Married and had six children.
And you just didn't realize the chance you were taking?
I didn't until I was so far gone.
Uh-huh.
That, you might say I got in a position where I couldn't help myself.
You mean you were just powerless to resist the urge?
You just can't live without it. You're miserable, you're uncomfortable, and yet you eventually reach a state where it don't bring you quite up to normal. Your mind don't function.
Yeah.
You can't think in the courtroom. You're depressed. And, of course, all your clients see that. The public sees that.
Yeah.
And it just simply destroys you.
That's the way it is with dope. It's no respecter of rank or position. Or brains. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are, what country, what town or city, or what side of the tracks you live on. How do everyday people come to this? Why do they do it? Here are some answers from addicts themselves.
I was working on the railroad at the time, and I met some fellas that used it. Finally coached me to take a shot. They said it would give you a good boot.
It was just that I was extremely nervous, emotionally upset.
Well, it was through ill health. Got addicted by kidney stone. Yes, sir, it relieved the pain. After they got the stones out, I had something worse than a kidney stone, a narcotic habit.
Unfortunately, I've been an addict all my life. I was only a kid. I'm an old lady now. I'm 59. I was on drugs before I was old enough to attend school.
There are many reasons given by the patients for being hooked on drugs. What does their medical director, Dr. Victor Vogel, think?
Well, the answer, of course, depends on a thorough knowledge of what makes the man tick. We've got to help the man understand why he wanted to take drugs. In most cases, it depends on helping the man to an understanding of some emotional or psychiatric difficulty. We find in the great majority of our histories of patients here that they became addicts from association with others who were addicts. Narcotic addiction is a communicable disease, just as truly almost as typhoid fever or diphtheria or smallpox.
So narcotics addiction is a contagious disease. It affects all countries regardless of boundaries. Since all the deals between the peddlers and the users are secret, there's no way of estimating the dollars, pesos, pounds, or yen of stuff that's sold each day. And all that means quick profits for the peddler and a sure market, a soft racket. But there's always the risk of being caught. That's why prices are high. For example, the legal price for an ounce of morphine is $15. The peddler's price, $2,000. It isn't often that we get the lowdown from the peddler himself, as our UN reporter did.
Were you pretty sick when you came in?
I wasn't sick.
Well, how'd you get here?
I was brought here by two marshals.
Well, how did you come into contact with narcotics?
I was selling narcotics.
Yeah, well, how did you take it up?
Well, just idea of making money, that's all. Well,
what'd you think? There was an easy way of getting some money?
I did at first, but now I see it's not.
Not so good, huh?
That's right.
Well, did you realize at the very beginning what effect it would have on other people who were using it?
No, I didn't.
You were just interested in the commercial aspects
of it, right?
Pete the peddler was anxious to sell, to make a fast dollar. The addict is even more anxious to buy the drug. That's one of the great handicaps in drying up the illicit dope racket. The smuggler, the peddler, the customer. Each protects the other, and all three protect the shooting gallery, the place where you get the shot of dope. Shooting gallery is just one expression in the Narcotics Underworld Dictionary. There are a lot more. We asked Elliot about it. Elliot is 62. He's been doing time since 1926.
Elliot, tell me, I heard somebody use the expression around here, artillery. Does that mean anything?
That is a hypodermic, a spoon, and what it takes to use a shot.
What other words can you think of?
Well, if the guy's going out, he says, well, where can I score? You mean, where can he find stuff? Is there a connection around here?
Oh.
That means, is there some guy selling stuff? Well, if he no connection, where can I make a croaker?
A croaker?
Well, if you find a doctor, he'll take care of him.
Is that what they call doctors? Croakers?
Yeah.
What do they call morphine?
They call it smack.
If a man is going to be using cocaine, how would he refer to cocaine?
Well, you say happy dust, probably.
Happy dust. Now, what do they call the fellow who's the brains behind the narcotics ring?
They call it the real people and that used to do the importing, the syndicate.
The syndicate?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was the first man that got the stuff when he came off the boat.
What do they call a federal narcotics agent?
Well, uncle.
Yeah, they call a federal narcotics agent uncle? Supposing a man wants to say to you, I'm taking dope. How does he say it?
Well, he says, I'm on stuff.
I'm on stuff, huh?
Another guy said, well, what are you doing? You using a junk now?
Yeah.
Sure, I'm using stuff.
Not a pretty picture. Seeing a man of 62 with a wasted life. Just another case of a fellow who never had a chance, that's what you're probably thinking. The fact is that Elliot, the dope addict, is a graduate electrical engineer. It's bad enough when a grown person is on the stuff. But what of a child addict, hooking a youngster? As UN reporter Sparks made his way from one end of Narco to the other, he saw a young boy enter, carrying a suitcase. Sparks set up his portable microphone and secured what is probably the only actuality tape recording ever made of a teenager being admitted for narcotics treatment.
Dr. Vogel, what would you call this, the admissions office?
This is the admissions unit, yes.
Sir, do you mind if I sort of eavesdrop on the gentleman who is admitting this man here?
Not at all, providing his identity is not revealed.
All right, then. Now we'll write down here the amount that you have remaining, which is $3.50. Which will be properly deposited.
Excuse me, what is your name?
Shurik.
And you're a member of the U.S. Public Health Service?
That's right.
If you don't mind, I'd like to just stay by here and eavesdrop.
Very well.
Yeah, what is your work?
I was going to school.
How old are you?
I'm 18.
You're 18. Well, how long have you been on drugs?
Well, approximately about a year and a half. Or so.
About a year and a half.
Well, I suppose.
Well, how'd you start it?
This curiosity.
You thought that you were going to get a big bang out of it, huh?
Well, yeah, in a way.
And what else did you expect?
I didn't know what to expect. That's why I was curious. I guess curiosity makes a lot of people do different things.
Well, what did you try first? Morphine or heroin or cocaine or marijuana? What was it?
Well, heroin.
Heroin. You had to buy it?
Yes, it wasn't given to me. Yes, I had to buy it.
Where'd you buy it? You don't have to tell me exactly where, but I mean from a peddler or from a...
I guess you would call it a peddler.
I mean, you had to find him.
If you were curious, I guess you find some sort of way to find a person like that.
I see. How long were you on it?
I'd been on it about 2 years.
In other words, you really started using it when you were about 16.
At the end of 15, going into 16, yeah.
Uh-huh. What would you tell any of your friends who were your age about the stuff, who haven't tried it yet? What would you tell them?
Well, I'd probably say that it leads to nothing, you know. From what I've experienced, it didn't do me any good.
You go right ahead with your processing there. I'm sorry to have interrupted.
That's all right. Are both of your parents living at this time?
Yes.
And the extent of your education to date?
The senior year of high school.
Completed the senior year of high school?
No, I didn't complete
this it. This boy is now entering a new world of hope. His first step at Narco is the most important. It's called withdrawal. The hospital's director, Dr. Vogel, tells us just what that means.
Withdrawal refers to the period during which patients are removed from the drug, or to put it the other way, the drug's removed from the patient. Withdrawal may be accomplished abruptly, or as the patients call it, cold turkey. Most withdrawals these days are tapering or gradually diminishing withdrawals in which the drug is gradually reduced over a period of 5 to 30 days, depending on the practice in the particular hospital. Here, our practice is to substitute a different narcotic drug. It's a synthetic drug. This drug is substituted for morphine or heroin, which is usually being taken on the outside, because withdrawal from the substituted drug, methadone, is less uncomfortable than from morphine or heroin. We feel it's inhumane and causes needless suffering to patient who's been taking large amounts of drugs off abruptly.
Experts will tell you that addiction begins in the mind, whether the victim is a thrill seeker or is trying to avoid facing a problem. And that is why it is so important to root out depression, anxiety, and put in its place constructive, creative things. These give the mind satisfactions far beyond the fraudulent power of drugs. At Narco, you can see the wonders accomplished through occupational therapy in the cabinet-making shops, the farm, the dairy, the gardens, the studio. Here, finding new interests are men and women whose only previous concern in life had been a hypodermic of dope. Like this elderly lady with a talent she's just discovered. Painting.
That's an oil painting. That's oil, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That isn't watercolor.
Oh, no.
It's a very lovely thing.
This is supposed to be a table and a vase of flowers. And then there's this here. I'm going to put some vines in it. That's another little vase. See, that's the object over here. I painted it from that object there. The main thing is to work. I found that out. And then you get that peace of mind that nothing compares with it.
Yes. Haven't you discovered that...
In this picture and painting?
Yes.
Oh, it's the most wonderful thing, the most fascinating thing I've ever undertaken to do.
You have a self-expression.
That's right.
If you have something
That's
to say,
right.
you say it right on the
That's
painting.
That's right. And then if you make a little mistake, you can cover that up so beautifully.
Are you going to frame this picture when it's finished?
Oh, I wouldn't part with this picture. I'm going to frame it and keep it forever. Because in this picture, at one time, I had a darker... And then it come lighter. In the recesses of my mind, I could see that darkness leaving. And I craved that light, and that's why I did it over so many times.
That's beautiful. But you've forgotten one thing.
What's that?
Your signature on the corner.
Oh, no. I don't want fame. I just want peace of mind.
Peace of mind. We've come a long way from handling a narcotics addict as a criminal to our present approach of treating him as a sick patient, which he is. But treating the patient after he has the disease is still but one step in solving the narcotics problem. The vicious circle has to be broken, and that starts with a surprising fact. A fact we'll hear about from a world authority as our UN microphone goes right into the narco research laboratory. Perhaps the greatest center for this type of investigation in existence. Here, scientists are probing for the answers. Over there is Dr. Isbell investigating sleeping pills. Dr. Altschul at the electroencephalograph studying the brain waves of addicts. Dr. Nathan B. Eddy of the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, a world authority on narcotics, is observing there. He is the chairman of the expert committee on habit-forming drugs of the UN's World Health Organization. He's been asked a question which probably goes right to the heart of the dope problem. Here is the answer.
We have not made a pain-relieving drug which is free of habit-forming quality.
Then I understand that to this date, there is no drug which has the property of killing pain which can be stated definitely as being free from the danger of incurring a habit.
That is true.
Well, is this laboratory in which we are standing now, is this laboratory concerned with the discovery of such a thing?
In this sense, that one of its functions or one of its activities has been to determine the habit-forming qualities of these new synthetic substances, morphine derivatives and so on, which we hoped might have adequate pain-relieving power with less habit-forming quality.
Well, if a man takes marijuana, for example, does that build up his sense of invincibility so that he can go out and rob a bank, let us say, without any fear?
No.
Does any drug give that?
No.
I was speaking to one of the patients. He said that after a shot, he felt like Superman.
Well, drugs don't make criminals. They're already criminals. The drug may make it easier for them to commit the criminal act, but the criminal tendency was there to start with.
I know that you are chairman of the Committee on Habit-Forming Drugs of the WHO, the World Health Organization, the specialized agency of the United Nations.
Okay.
How does the United Nations come into this picture at all?
If you want any adequate control over a narcotic drug, a habit-forming drug, it's got to be at the international level.
Therefore, the United Nations is the logical, practical agency for doing that?
Definitely.
Can you think of any other way of handling it?
No, because the different nations will have different degrees of control, and unless it is uniform, unless there is interchange of information about the amount of drug produced and shipped from one country to another, no matter how tight the control is in this country, you haven't adequate control.
You know, somebody once criticized Abraham Lincoln for telling some humorous stories during the darkest days of the war between the states. Lincoln replied that war is no laughing matter, but that he was sure a laugh made war a little more possible to bear. Narcotics addiction is no laughing matter either. But here, too, a laugh now and then helps a lot, all around. Our reporter, in his tour through Narco, saw tears, but also some smiles in the answers given his questions as he carried his microphone to the tables in the cafeteria.
How much do you weigh?
245.
Well, how did you get mixed up with this stuff?
Just a coincidence.
Coincidence?
Yeah. Well, this time, see, I'm here for marijuana.
What sort of a sensation do you get out of marijuana?
Sometimes I think the world's mine.
Yeah, but how long does that affect
last? That lasts you about 2.5 hours to 3 hours.
I see. Then you have to smoke again.
Yeah.
Well, you can't keep doing it, can you?
Well, if I don't keep smoking, I just keep drinking. I've got to keep a gauge up.
Dr. Vogel, do you think that he needs this?
I must tell him right here before all of you listening that he's not as smart as he looks.
Well, that might be right. See, but, Doc, I mean, I never had a shot in my life. Nothing but whiskey. I mean, I woke up a minute Monday morning. I got a shot all right, but it was out of glass.
Well, the way these men around here are laughing, I don't think they quite believe you.
Well, I mean, just a matter of fact, I mean, I look at it like this. I mean, see, out there in the street, yeah. Everybody, I mean, they get some kind of kicks.
I don't agree that everybody looks for a kick.
I mean, everybody that I associate with.
Well, you better... You better find different associates then.
Well, I think, but I hope we'll meet again, Jeff. It won't be him. It'll be in the city of New York.
Yeah. I don't know.
Addiction to narcotics was once considered to be just a local affair. Today, dope addiction is more than ever a matter of international concern. Now, international action against illegal traffic in drugs isn't new, but the scope and methods being employed by the United Nations are new. Here is just one example. Somewhere on the East Coast, there's a United Nations Detection Center which can trace and determine where opium is coming from. In a moment, by special tape recording, you will look over the shoulder of a UN chemist at work. First, come behind the scene at Washington, D.C. and meet the chief of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Mr. Harry J. Anslinger. Mr. Anslinger holds the all-important post of American representative on the UN's Commission for Narcotic Drugs. He is questioned by another UN reporter, Michael Haywood.
What have you found to be the chief problem in your fight against illicit narcotics traffic?
The chief problem, as we see it, is to determine the country of origin of smuggled opium, because that is the source of all the illicit traffic, not only in this country, but in the whole world. Some 5 years ago, we started a laboratory in Washington, and by scientific analyses, we have been able to determine just where the smuggled opium has come from.
I assume what you're talking about is the new laboratory that you turned over to the United Nations together with its chief chemist, Dr. Fulton.
We were only too glad to turn over the laboratories and personnel to the United Nations for this purpose. This is a worldwide problem, and so many of the delegates whose countries had in the past been charged with being sources of origin had said, give us some proof that this opium has come from our country. Mm-hmm. From now on, there shouldn't be any doubt.
Now to the detection center, the exact location of which cannot be revealed. UN scientists are at their jobs. A reporter holds a chunk of raw opium in his hand. He turns to the chief chemist, Dr. Fulton.
Well, what would you say about this? Can you ascribe it to any country just on the basis of the looks?
It looks like Indian opium. I have here some different kinds of other opium that we might compare with it.
Yes.
Here's some Turkish opium. Notice that the texture is granular and it isn't nearly so dark.
What's that long stick you have in your hand?
That's a form in which Iranian opium often comes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's your next step in determining the origin?
The next step is to make a microscopic test. Now, when you look at it here under the microscope...
May I look into the microscope?
Oh, yes. You look and yes. You'll see...
What shall I look for?
You'll see that there are long rods there.
Oh, I see them. Little rectangular things, aren't they?
Yes.
Well, is that pretty conclusive evidence by now, or do you take the thing further?
Well, we take it considerably further. That's pretty conclusive considering the appearance, but we want to make some chemical tests and determine the amount of some of the alkaloids that are present.
Where is the main opium center?
It's grown largely in the Balkans, in Turkey, Iran, India, China, Mongolia, Asiatic Russia, Korea, Burma, Siam, and some other countries.
With narcotics, both natural and synthetic, capable of coming from so many different places, it is obvious that anything but effective world control is no control. UN reporter Hayward asks the opinion of a representative of one of the countries where opium is grown, India. Mr. Gopala Menon, member of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs.
Mr. Menon, do you feel that the new United Nations laboratory will strengthen the UN fight to break up illicit drug traffic around the world?
I have no doubt at all, because for the first time you find that we will be able to find out exactly what the source of the opium is by internal chemical foolproof evidence. And there can't be anything better than that to tackle this question of illicit traffic.
Mm-hmm. Is the Indian government going to cooperate with the UN laboratory?
Oh, yes. The Indian government has already done its very best. And Mr. Anslinger has paid a tribute to the Indian government for their cooperation recently. And hereafter, sir, certainly we will be sending all our samples to the UN laboratory.
What does it all add up to? The doctor, the lawyer, the peddler, the boy, the woman who found peace in painting, the investigators, the UN laboratory. It adds up to a family of nations working together to prevent more tragedies like the ones you've been listening to.
I met some fellows that used it, finally coaxed me to take a shot.
I was extremely nervous, emotionally upset.
Well, it was through ill health.
Unfortunately, I've been an addict all my life.
Today, all legal trade in narcotics is under the control of the United Nations. The UN Narcotics Commission, with the Drug Supervisory Body and Central Opium Board, strictly regulate how much narcotics each country may import, export, and manufacture. By increasing international vigilance, investigation, research, and effective worldwide control, the illicit drug problem can be solved. When that day comes, narcotics will still perform its medical miracles and yet not wreck lives. Like that of 62-year-old Elliot, with whom our UN reporter spoke in the addiction ward of a narcotics hospital.
Are you married, Elliot?
No.
Were you ever married?
No.
Didn't you ever want to be married?
Yeah.
Well, what happened? Disappointed?
This.
Third in a new series of United Nations broadcasts, Mr. Gary Cooper was featured as guest narrator. This eyewitness account of illicit narcotics traffic, its victims, and its control was prepared for radio by Jeff Sparks. All recordings heard were completely authentic. In order to protect the identity of the patients who appeared on this broadcast, no last names were used. Music was composed and conducted by Irving Zathmary. The program was produced by Gerald Keane of United Nations Radio.